what I want to do is going to be during class and also during the sermon. We're going to talk about the problems of God in our lives. And I think the older we get, the more we think about that in our lives, because we have had so many things in the past that have occurred in our life. And we studied the Bible all our lives and so forth. And same things become just more and more meaningful the older that we get. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start out just simply talking about, where did I point this thing? Make my point. Anybody know where I point this thing?
I pointed at the screen. I thought maybe. I don't know. You got to turn these on. Oh, there it is. Thank you. There's two of them up here.
Louis, there's an on switch on there?
Yeah, and it's on. Oh, there we go. This one works, the other one didn't. All right, let's see if it see if we can hang in there.
Well, I'm not very young, am I? All right, I want to just simply mention our attitude toward the Bible. There's people that, even some that I know in the family, that decided that there is no God. And when you decide there's no God, of course, that's because you go to universities and teachers are teaching you and others are, you know, trying to get your confidence out of that. But when you quit believing in God, then what does the Bible mean? It just, yeah, there's no life to it. It doesn't mean anything. And if you don't have that, then what about your own life? You know, where do you go? What's going to lead you? What's going to direct you? So I just have our attitude toward the Bible has been our attitude toward God. Is the Bible just meaningless history, a set of cold rules and regulations, or is it essential to having a close relationship with God? Well, it is. And we need to understand that the Bible has so much life when we recognize and understand God, and it's talking about always God and the things that God does, the workings of God. Is God active when He's not working through miracles? You know, that's what, if there's a miracle, then okay, we would believe in God. And when people today don't see miracles, they think, well, you know, you people don't believe in God like you should. There have got to be miracles. As if God is not working and cannot work the things that He does fantastically if there's no miracles. But when you see a miracle, Lazarus was raised from the dead, there was no doubt. That just wasn't something that naturally occurred. There had to be the power of God. It was a miracle. But when there is not a miracle, you know, is God still working? What is the difference between miracles and providence? And that's what I just was talking about. The providence of God, you don't see any miracles. But God is working, and He's working great things in our lives, working great things in nations and so forth. And we see that all the way through the Bible, where God wasn't working a miracle, but things happened that really changed things on the face of the earth in fantastic ways. Can God accomplish all His purposes today without miracles? You know, He can He? We don't have to have miracles. Miracles were there so that, like Jesus, when He worked miracles, He could prove that He was the Son of God. He couldn't do this if God wasn't with Him. So don't tell me when I say I'm the Son of God that I'm not, because if I can work these miracles, you know without any doubt that I am. And then belief in God's providence is important as to how we view our daily lives and how we view events of our day and time. I want you to start turning over to the book of Esther. Actually, I turned over the wrong place, to the book of Esther, because that's what we're going to be talking about. I think in our life today, and I know as I've gotten older, there's sometimes that some in your life some very significant thing happens. And you say, wow, that happened. Everything came together. And you're fantastically impressed by it. And you don't realize until you've gone on, even sometimes you pass on from there, you start thinking back on your life. And when you think back on your life, you remember that when that great thing happened, that great occasion occurred, and you stop thinking, you start thinking about things that happened before that. And if those things that happened before that had not happened, then that great thing that was so significant, the other things seemed to be insignificant at the time, but if they hadn't happened, this other thing would not have occurred. There's some times, and I don't tell any stories, we all can tell stories like that, where we're looking for houses, where we move from one place to another as a preacher. Very difficult to sell your house and go buy another one, especially at a distance and so forth. But all the things sometimes just come together and you finally find a house. It's just a perfect circumstance and situation. But when you look back on what, when that finally, oh great, it finally happened. And then you start, oh, you know, this happened and that happened and that. This would not have happened unless these, and we just thought those were things that just happened on a regular basis now and then. So that's what we want to look at. There are things that just so happened, but they lead to some very significant things in our life. So we wonder why certain things happen, and the day comes when we realize why and that God was working in it all. Today, God is working as much as He ever has. Today, in modern America, in our political realm, all what's going on today, oh my goodness. And I just sit back. You pray about things, you think about them, you listen to it, but I wonder, what is God doing? And I may die before I see some fantastic, oh, that's where it was all going. But I tell you what, God is working in that way. And Ecclesiastes 3:1, for everything there, the season and the time, for every purpose under the sun. Romans 8:28 is talking about to them that love God, all things work together for good to them that love the Lord. Now that doesn't mean everything that happens in a life is good. If we oh, that was good, I'm glad for that. No. But God is working everything. Whatever happened, bad things happen, good things happen. But ultimately, what God is working in our life is that which is good if we are faithful to Him and we trust Him. And I'm thinking of, thought of a passage of Scripture that's not up there, Ephesians 3:20. Now unto Him that is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us, in Him be glory in the church, so forth, according to the power that works in us. So He's able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we pray about. We pray about, oh, I really wish this, but I'm not sure. And then someday we can find out, and it's happened throughout history, that some things happened that are far greater than the things we prayed about because we didn't think that would ever happen. But God worked. And that's what then, there's a lot of places we go to in the Bible for this kind of thing, but what we want to do is go to the story of Esther. And the interesting thing about the story of Esther, and you all know that story, I know the account, is that God is not mentioned in the book. His name is not brought up. But when you read through that book, that history that occurred and so forth, when you get through, you say, oh my, look what God did. That was fantastic. And there's not a miracle in the book. But God did wonderful works. So let's look at that. We don't have time to really cover everything, but we're going to try to do it the best way that we can. And what I'm going to do is there's going to look at some passages, and there are more that we could probably spot, but just some things. Open your Bible or your phone or whatever, however you do it, and let's look at the book of Esther. And what we want to see is the things that happened. And a lot of things that happened, you could say, that just happened. Just so happened. It just so happened. It just so happened. But before it's all done, wow, look at what God did. And then we need to move that ultimately to application to our lives. So we start out, and there's a couple of passages. Let's just start out in the book. We know that Esther was, at the time, the king that's mentioned here is Ahasuerus. His other name is Xerxes. And he was king at that time. He was king from 486 to about 464. And it was during the time that ultimately that we're going to be looking at, we know in the other books, the history books, that, Ezra, Nehemiah, the Zerubbabel came to build the temple. They were let out of Babylonian captivity, came back home, and began to build the temple. And the things that are happening here is right toward the end of the time when they were finishing up building the temple, and before Ezra came and began to teach them the law again and so forth. That's when Ezra fit into the book, or Esther fit into the book of Ezra. And so here, Ahasuerus, this Persian empire, is from India all the way over down to Ethiopia. So it was a larger kingdom, empire than what Babylon was. And the next one, the Greek is going to be bigger. And then, of course, Rome. It's heading toward that direction. And when Rome is there, that's when Jesus is going to come. And yet, ultimately, die on the cross, provide salvation. And then, I heard it go down. Is that better? Okay. I thought, well, I heard it ringing, but I didn't know everybody else did. But anyway, so God is going to be ultimately sending the gospel out during the time of the Roman Empire. And that's going to be an empire that spread the broadest it has ever been, and the gospel is going to be able to spread throughout the whole world. So things are progressing in that direction. So here we're in Persia, but Ahasuerus, his father, Darius, had gone against the Greeks and had failed miserably in the Battle of Marathon. A lot of you have heard about that. And they were trying to conquer the Greeks. He couldn't do it. Well, Ahasuerus, his son, decided, then I will do that. I will make that happen. So before he does, he has this great big party. That's what the first chapter here is about. He has this great big party for all the princes, for all the kings, for all those that are important in his empire, even the servants. And he has this great feast. And in that time, he's serving everybody. It lasts for 6 months. I think that's down in verse... where was it? Down in verse 4. And for 6 months, and during that time, he was showing everybody the wealth that he had. What he was trying to do was get as many people from all over the empire to come, princes, and those that could support him in what he's going to do. He's getting ready to provide the means where he can get an army together and go over and fight against the Greeks and defeat them. And that's going to take a great army, going to take a lot of money, a lot of talent and everything else. So he's trying to get as many people with him, so he has this. And then for 1 week after that, he has the feast for just the people there in Shushan, the palace. Shushan was the place that was the winter palace for the Persian kingdom, and that's where they were. And so he does this, and at the end of it, at verse 9, toward the end of it, during that week, also Vashti the queen made a feast for the women. So she's done, his queen had done that for the women. Well, now what he wants to do, he's a little bit on the drunken side, and everything's happy, and he wants everybody to see his beautiful wife, and how wonderful she is. And of course, she knows what the condition of all these guys are and the people out there. And when he says, you come in and I want you to, you know, stand before them and show your beauty to them before this tremendous crowd, she does not want to do it. And that's what we get in chapter 1 and verse 12. It says, but the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment by the chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth, and his anger burned in him. She didn't do what I told her to do. He just coming apart. Happy night. Probably not the first time that ever happened. And so he did that, and now what is he going to do about that? Well, the other princes, the chamberlains and so forth, as mentioned down in the verses below that, they all got to try to come to some wisdom. What do we do about this? And in verse 16 it says, and you can answer before the king and the princes, Vashti the queen has not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes. So because of what she's done, every other prince in this nation and every husband is going to be looked upon contemplatively by the wife. She's all their women. Oh, if Vashti got away with this, I don't have to do what you say. And all the women are going to be, we can't have that in our kingdom. And so they're trying to figure out, and you've been decided that, you know, we can't allow this to happen. So what it comes down to is verse 16, and Eucan answered before the king and the princess, Vashti the queen has not done wrong to the king only. That's what I just mentioned. And so what they did is that we need to send a letter out to everybody. And what we're going to do is she will no longer, down in verse 18, she'll no longer be queen. We have to choose someone else to be queen. She's got to be, and then everybody will understand, you better do what your husband says, otherwise bad things like this will happen. And so it was sent out that she would be, in verse 19, in verse 19, that Vashti came no more before the king Ahasuerus, and let the king give his royal estate to another. So now they got to choose another queen. And so that's where we go to in chapter 2. After, in verse 1, it talks about Ahasuerus, after some time passed, he felt very bad. You know, he remembered Vashti, and, what did I do? But you can't change this now. And so they said, we've got to find somebody else. And so in chapter 2, what they do is they send out many servants to go out and looking for virgin women and find someone that Vashti or Ahasuerus or Xerxes will say, that's the one that I choose. Now remember what's going on all this during this time. Things are just happening. He is trying to get together a great army to go fight against the Greeks and so forth. So while he's getting that ready, and then finally he's going to go take off, and he's going to go to fight that battle, and Thermopylae and Salamis in 479, that's when he fails himself. A very miserable circumstance. He sat there on the hillside and looked out there and saw the last naval battle occur, and that it just went all down. He just headed home. But when he headed home, what was happening is what's been happening. When he headed home, he had to find a wife, find one of these virgins, and maybe that would give him some comfort again and so forth. And he never went after the Greeks again. But all this happened. That was between Ezra 6 and 7. Well, after the temple was built, that's when this sort of thing happened that was going on. And what happens had occurred that the enemies of the Jews wanted to take place, it would have been miserable all over that kingdom, all the way to Palestine, where they built the temple again. There, this man Haman in his book wanted to slaughter all the Jews and tell everybody in that whole kingdom, slaughter the Jews and take what they have. That would have been very devastating. But anyway, they went out looking for people. In verse 5 in chapter 2, it says, there was a certain Jew. Now this just so happened. There was a certain Jew in Shushan the palace whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, which rings the bell, doesn't it? A Benjamite. And he'd been carried away into captivity by the captivity. I won't read it all, but in 597, during the time of Jeconiah, that was the second time the Babylonians came in, took a group of the Jews away. He was in that group at that time that was taken into captivity. And it says, verse 7, and he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. So her parents died. These two, Mordecai and Esther, were cousins. He was older. He adopted her, and she became basically his daughter. That's what it just so happened. They happened to be here in Shushan the palace. And then from there, we go on down to, we got 8 and 9 here. And then we go on down to verse 19 through 23 later. But what happens on the way to there is that they went out looking for many maidens. And in verse 9 it says, and the maiden, when they found Esther, it says, and the and Esther means star, or somebody else says compassion or whatnot, but anyway, star is the name for Esther. And it says, verse 9, and the maiden pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him. It mentions a man by the name Hegai. He was one of the chamberlains. And when he saw Esther, she pleased him very much, which meant that he did everything and supported her in the most fantastic way of all those that were going to be going before the king. So she was very beautiful. And then she had a tremendous amount of help to prepare herself to be ready to come before the king. And when she does, then she is chosen to be his queen. Verse 16 of chapter 2. So Esther was taken unto the king Ahasuerus into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. That was in 7 or 479, and that was the year that he failed to conquer the Greeks and came back home. So he comes back home, and he's going to be with Esther after he failed so much. And I think he might have been taught a little bit in that loss of fighting against the Greeks and so forth. He comes back, maybe a little more humble, settled down, and Esther becomes his queen. And they make a great feast for her, which they keep at all times, Esther's feast, in verse 18. Then verse 19, which we come to, says, and when the virgins were gathered together the second time, there Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate. So Esther had not yet made known her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him. So he says, don't tell anybody that you're a Jew. Keep that quiet. You understand why? Because there was a lot of enmity against the Jews. So if you're going to go there, but that doesn't mean it's just something you don't want to tell anybody. Then verse 21, in those days, while Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate, that's where he hung out, staying close to the king's gate, that's where Mordecai, in the area where Esther was, seeing how things were going with her. But it says, he was sitting in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh. Big man and Teresh. I remember Teresh, right? That kind of fits me better what their name was. Of those that kept the threshold were raw and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the thing became known to Mordecai, who showed it to unto Esther the queen, and Esther told the king thereof, in Mordecai's name. So she comes in and tells the king, there's two people that want to kill you, they're your chamberlains, and telling you that. And so she told him, and this is Mordecai, my adopted father, he's the one that told me about this. And so he checks it out, he finds out that's true, and so he puts those people, two people to death, and writes this that happened. It just so happens that Mordecai heard that and knew what was going on. Just happened to be there, happened to hear somebody else, but it was told to the king and so forth. They wrote it down in the Chronicles of the King. They didn't go out and honor him. They didn't do anything for him. It just ignored Mordecai. It was a great thing he did, but it was written down. This will happen. At least it was written down. For now, that's the way it is. And then we go on into chapter 3, and that's when we get to this man, Haman. And when we come to Haman, he's the man that has the Ahasuerus. He's a very a man of high standing. That Ahasuerus feels like if I put him in a high position, he's going to be very helpful in my kingdom. That's what he thinks. That's what he's thinking. And so he makes him the highest of all the princes in his whole kingdom, from India to Ethiopia. Wow, what an impressive thing! But Mordecai, when he would come out of the king's palace, he would come out walking, everybody bowing before him, just showing him all of his honor. There's Mordecai over there. And Mordecai doesn't do it. And he initially does not notice that, but everybody else that was bowing down is, man, what are you doing, Mordecai? So we go to Mordecai, what are you doing? You're not bowing down before him. Well, I'm not going to do it because I'm a Jew. I don't know, we won't get into that. Haman was an Agagite. That may go back in the books of Numbers and so forth. And Exodus, the Amalekites, remember King Agag, and so my connect with that, it has been enemies for years. I don't know whether that's why he didn't bow down before him, or he just wasn't going to pay that kind of glory to just a man. But when these other fellows find out you're a Jew, then they go tell Haman about this, and when he hears about it, it just angers him way beyond the throne. He is so angry. What he decides to do is, I'm going to kill all the Jews. So verse 7, 6 and 7 there, says, but he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had made known to him that people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout all the land, the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the king, even the people of Mordecai. And as you know, then they sat down after that. That's where verse 7 goes. And he with all his buddies, they sit down and they begin to throw dice, as it were, cast lots to find out when are we going to do this. And they just do it constantly. Every month, you know, just day after day, you know. And it finally comes up to when it's going to happen. And this is in the first month, verse 7, the first month of the year. But they cast lots. It's going to be in the last month, the 12th month of the year. And it turns out, verse 13, the 12th month and the 13th day. And he goes to the king and asks the king if he can do this. I'm going to destroy a nation of people that they will not obey your laws. They are people that are destructive to this kingdom. And I have to agree with them. And he says, oh, whatever you want. Yeah, go ahead and do it. And so they set it up, send out letters to everybody on horseback. And they had the post service that was the most fantastic in those days in the Persian Empire. One of the times that it really got started so well. And they sent it all over the empire from India to Ethiopia. This letter saying, comes the 12th month on the 13th day, anybody in this kingdom can go fight against Jews and slaughter them and take everything they have. Just so happens. These are things that happen. Oh man, the Jews are going to be destroyed. They could be destroyed in Palestine where they built a temple. Wow! And so what a fantastic. Well, the next passage is, as we get into chapter 4, when Mordecai hears about this, it just tears him up. He's in great agony, puts on sackcloth and ashes, and he goes out where clearly that from Esther's window, they can see him. He knows she can see him. And so one of the persons that's mentioned there, what's that chapter 4? In verse 5 of Hatach. That was one of the king's chamberlains that is helping with Esther. And when they look out the window, they see that she sends Hatach out to ask him what's going on. And of course, when this person comes to Mordecai, he tells him what is going to take place and what's going to happen. I'm switching over there in chapter 4 then. In verse 9 following is when he suggested that Esther, you go in before the king and you tell him what is going to happen. Of course, when that happens, then he's going to find out she's Jew. And that might be. And here, they're going to slaughter the Jews, and just so happens, the queen of this king is a Jew. He says, well, it looks like to me that she could go in and talk to her husband, the king, and get him not to do this. And so he tells her that. She said, well, and that's the kind of law they had. Well, I tell you what, if you go in to see the king and he doesn't ask you to come, you're put to death. Unless he reaches out and hands his, what is it? His, what is it? Yeah, the scepter. That's what's happening. I get older, can't think of a word anymore. So if he hands the golden scepter, then you can come in and talk to him. She says, he hasn't called me in 30 days. This is risky. It could kill me. Then in verse 13 is what's important. Then Mordecai bade them return answer and Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then will relief and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house will perish, and who knows whether thou art not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. It just so happens that she's queen at a time like this. God's name is not mentioned, but Mordecai obviously has trust and belief in God. He knows that if you don't do this, there'll be some kind of relief or deliverance that will arise from some other place. I don't know. And all Esther decides is faith. I'm going to put my life on the line. I'll go ahead and do it. And so she determines to do that. And then we move on from there in chapter 5. And there in verse 2, it says, then it was so when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter. Well, it just so happened that he held up the golden scepter, and she was able to come in. And she had a request. And her request was, you remember, I want you and this man Haman. I'm inviting you to a very special banquet. And you both would come. And so that afternoon, and so forth, you can come. And so he goes back in, tells Haman that he's invited. Oh, man, wow. Woo! I've been invited with the king by the queen to come in. Boy, this is something very special. His head is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then he does, why Esther, of course that's why Esther does this. She's pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Maybe she's helping his pride to get bigger and bigger, and it's going to lead to maybe something that will lead to destruction of this man. Sue Brennan, then, they said they have the banquet, but she doesn't tell the king at this time what she wants, what the request is. So he says, will you tell me what your request is? Well, I'll take, if you'll come back in tomorrow for the banquet, that's when I'll take. So both of you do it. Oh boy, you're going to get to do it again. And when he comes out of that banquet with that big head, he sees Mordecai. He's now looking for that man Mordecai, and he's not bowing down before him. And it says, what does it say? Verse 9, and he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman refrained himself and went home, and he sent and fetched his friends and Zeresh's wife. And so he brought them all together and talked to them about what happened here, and showed them all his riches and the favor that he's gotten and so forth. And so what they say, and here's this man Mordecai, well, I'll tell you what you do, Haman. Just build a gallows for this man and hang him on it tomorrow. Oh, yeah, let's just kill Haman. We'll take care of the rest of the Jews when the time comes. But we can kill Haman now. And they built Haman. Any of you remember how tall that thing was? 70 or 75 feet. And, you know, every time I read that, I go out and I look up. Oh! It's unbelievable that it would be that high. And they built it. Then he goes back in the next day to that banquet. Before that happens, on that night, verse 6. I'm pretty long here. Verse 6, or chapter 6, verse 1. The king couldn't sleep. Remember what he did? So he gets up, like sometimes we do some reading, or somebody's going to read for him. And guess what they read? It just so happened. Just so happened. They opened up to the Chronicles of the King and gets to the spot where it talks about what Mordecai had done. And they read that. And the first thing now the king says is, oh, what do we do for that man? How do we honor him? We did. Oh boy, we've got to honor that man. What are we going to do? And it just so happens again that that's when Haman comes marching in early in the morning to say, I'm going to hang this man, Mordecai. And when he comes in there to find out from the king if he's going to okay this and so forth, when he does so, the king said, oh, Haman, he knew somebody's out there. So he invited him, tell that man to come in. Haman came in. Oh, Haman, how you doing? I've got to ask you a question. How do we, there's a man that saved me from being killed. How do we, a great noble man like that, how do we honor him? And you all know who's Haman thinking about himself. And so he came to all, so hey, well, what you need to do is put on all the king's royal apparel. Then put him up on the royal horse and have your greatest prince to go before him and call out that this is what will be done to anybody that the king desires to honor. And he thinks it's going to be him on that horse and so forth. And he says, well, Haman, I want you to do that. You go out and do that to Mordecai. And his head is busted. I mean, we don't see it physically happening, but you know what's happening. It is destroying his brain on the inside. Yes, and he has to do it, so he goes out and does it. Then he comes home, then he has to tell them the rest of chapter 6 there. He tells his family and friends what happened, And lo and behold, it's very interesting. They said, Bill the Gallows, hang on him. Now they're saying, oh, that happened? And they begin to switch. They know the story about the Jews and God, Jehovah God, the God of Jews, and all the stories that we read about from one end to the other, all the way to Daniel and the end of the book. God has always been there, and people recognize who the God of the Jews is, and he's greater than everybody else. And so these people say, oh, if he's a Jew, it's over for you. You're going to yourself be destroyed. And so that's how the chapter ends. And he doesn't have time. Oh, tear down that big old gallows. He has to go into the banquet. And then in chapter 7, when he goes in the banquet, and that's when Esther, that's the last one we have. I've already said that this is happening between the 6 and 7 of the book of Esther. But in chapter 7, he says that Esther does make a request. And she tells the Ahasuerus that, please, verse 3, when Esther the queen answered and said, if I have found favor in my father, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, to perish. But if we had been sold for bondmen, and bondmen I had held my people, although the adversary could not have compensated for the king's damage. Then spake the king Ahasuerus and said unto Esther the queen, who is he? And where is he that durst presume to be this? This presumptuous man, he does not realize what he has accepted and allowed. He wasn't checking into it. That this means that his queen will be killed and all her people. He never asked about it. Foolish, isn't it? In fact, what it says in the book of Esther, when you read historically about Xerxes, it is there at the time of the man that he was. But anyway, when he does that, he gets angry. He walks out, and he's standing trying to figure out, what am I going to do? What? And he's thinking also, what have I done? I was a participant in this. But when he comes back walking in, that's when Haman comes up to Esther and says, and he's down there at her, where she's sitting, and he goes, are you assaulting her? Take him out. And then if he says, take him out and deal with him, this Harbona, one of those earlier ones that we mentioned in chapter 1 of the King Chamberlain, happened to know about this guy. Oh, king, and he must recognize that Haman is a person that needs to be brought down. He says, king, Haman built this great gallows to hang Mordecai on. Oh, okay. Hang Haman on that. And that's where it ends. Yep, they take him out and hang him. They kill his son and so forth. And then from there, they were just running out of time as we move along here. But the rest of the chapter, the book, is 8 to 10, is then they have to prepare. Once a law is made in the Persian kingdom, it could not be taken out of the book. Okay, take that law out, forget about it, it's not going to happen. You had to write some other law that somehow, some other way, that could replace that and take care of the problems that happened. Well, how do you do this? Well, they sat down, Mordecai and others sat down about this matter, said, we've got to send out another law in the third month. So now you've got 9 months left to send out the letter all over the kingdom from India to Ethiopia and let everybody know this is what's going on. This is going to happen. Get yourselves prepared. During that time, there are many people that were Gentiles that became Jews and stood on their side. So when the time came in Shushan, 500 people that came against the Jews, they were killed. It just turned out that Esther went to the king and said, could we do this another day? Well, the next day, 300 were killed. Now, they allowed others to come in and they killed 300. They didn't take anything that they owned. They didn't take the spoils. They were showing, we're not doing this to try to take the spoils of everybody and get rich. We're just dealing with our enemy. Isn't that something? Not a miracle anywhere. And things just so happened. And we haven't covered all of what we've been talking about and how all this came together. But it's like God always does. He just, you women that do reading and so forth, and you put together, what do you call those things? What? Whatever. I was thinking the word begins with P. Anyway, when you put together and read together this beautiful picture of something, it just gradually happens and it comes together and it gets all the way through. Wow. Look at this. And that's what this is. Who did this? God did it. Any miracle? Not one miracle at all. Providence? Yes. Things just happen. And all we want to do is end this with talking about the fact that there are things in our life, also where the things in our life open the brain. It really depends on what kind of people we are. What kind of faith we have. What kind of trust we have. Whether or not we realize that God is working. Can you use everybody in this room? God can use every last one of us. I don't know for what. He can't use one person for everything, but He will choose us all. If we are alert and if we are ready to serve God, just be thankful to Him and look what God can do through us. Some of us have been able to baptize people, teach them, and so forth. It just so happened. We run into that's how we met to the baby. But why did it all work out? Because we prayed to God. And there's an opportunity out there, let me know. And it just so happened that somebody comes along. And what have we done? We have studied. We have trained ourselves. Esther was that kind of a person. And when we do that, we are prepared and God can use it. If, on the other hand, we don't study the Bible, we don't learn how to teach anybody else, we don't prepare ourselves for what we can do, then God is not going to use us. Unless we turn against God and do things that are evil. God used some bad people here, did He? He used some bad people in what way? To accomplish His purposes of destroying the bad things that go on among the evil world. So He'll use us in whatever way. The New Testament first talks about that way. Vessels of honor or vessels of dishonor. It really depends on who we are. The greatness of God can be seen in our life. And I would say that probably in our lives there may be other things like, oh, I see how this all God has, and we praise God and thank Him because of how He works things. And the eternity, hopefully, what we'll find out is far greater things than we ever realized. That closing. Thank you for your attention.